the King's Road, though. And besides, Arya knelt in the dirt among the scattered clothes. She found a heavy woolen cloak, a velvet skirt, and a silk tunic, and some small clothes, a dress her mother had embroidered for her, a silver baby bracelet she might sell. Shoving the broken lid out of the way, she groped inside the chest for needle. She had hidden it way down at the bottom, under everything, but her stuff had all been jumbled around when the chest was dropped. For a moment Arya was afraid someone had found the sword and stolen it. Then her fingers felt the hardness of metal under a satin gown. "There she is!" a voice hissed close behind her. Startled, Arya whirled. A stable boy stood behind her, a smirk on his face, his filthy white undertunic peeking out from beneath a soiled jerkin. His boots were covered with manure, and he had a pitchfork in one hand. "Who are you?" she asked. "She don't know me," he said. "But I knows her, oh yes, the wolf girl." "Help me saddle a horse," Arya pleaded, reaching back into the chest, groping for needle. "My father's the hand of the king. He'll reward you." "Father's dead," the boy said. He shuffled toward her. "It's a queen who'll be rewarding me. Come here, girl."
"Stay away." Her fingers closed around needle's hilt.
"I says come."
He grabbed her arm hard. Everything Cyrio Forel had taught her vanished in a heartbeat. In that instant of sudden terror, the only lesson Arya could remember was the one Jon Snow had given her, the very first. She stuck him with a pointy end, driving the blade upward with a wild, hysterical strength. Needle went through his leather jerkin and the white flesh of his belly and came out between his shoulder blades. The boy dropped the pitchfork and made a soft noise, something between a gasp and a sigh. His hands closed around the blade.
"Oh, gods," he moaned, as his undertunic began to redden. "Take it out."
When she took it out, he died. The horses were screaming. Arya stood over the body, still and frightened in the face of death. Blood had gushed from the boy's mouth as he collapsed, and more was seeping from the slit in his belly, pooling beneath his body. His palms were cut where he'd grabbed at the blade. She backed away slowly, needle red in her hand. She had to get away, someplace far from here, someplace safe, away from the stable boy's accusing eyes. She snatched up the bridle and the harness again, and ran to her mare. But as she lifted the saddle to the horse's back, Arya realized with a sudden, sick dread that the castle gates would be closed. Even the postern doors would likely be guarded. Maybe the guards wouldn't recognize her. If they thought she was a boy, perhaps they'd let her... No. No, they'd have orders not to let anyone out. It wouldn't matter whether they knew her or not. But there was another way out of the castle. The saddle slipped from Arya's fingers and fell to the dirt with a thump and a puff of dust. Could she find the room with the monsters again? She wasn't certain, yet she knew she had to try. She found the clothing she'd gathered and slipped into the cloak, concealing needle beneath its folds. The rest of her things she tied in a roll. With the bundle under her arm, she crept to the far end of the stable. Unlatching the back door, she peeked out anxiously. She could hear the distant sound of swordplay, and the shivery wail of a man screaming in pain across the bailey. She would need to go down the serpentine steps, past the small kitchen and the pig yard. That was how she had gone last time, chasing the black tomcat. Only that would take her right past the barracks of the gold cloaks. She couldn't go that way. Arya tried to think of another way. If she crossed to the other side of the castle, she could creep along the river wall and through the little god's wood. But first she'd have to cross the yard, in the plain view of the guards on the walls. She had never seen so many men on the walls. Gold cloaks, most of them, armed with spears. Some of them knew her by sight. What would they do if they saw her running across the yard? She'd look so small from up there. Would they be able to tell who she was? Would they care? She had to leave now, she told herself, but when the moment came, she was too frightened to move. "Calm as still water," a small voice whispered in her ear. Arya was so startled, she almost dropped her bundle. She looked round wildly, but there was no one in the stable but her, and the horses and the dead men. "Quiet as a shadow," she heard. Was it her own voice, or Sirio's? She could not tell. Yet somehow it calmed her fears. She stepped out of the stable. It was the scariest thing she'd ever done. She wanted to run and hide, but she made herself walk across the yard, slowly, putting one foot in front of the other, as if she had all the time in the world and no reason to be afraid of anyone. She thought she could feel their eyes, like bugs crawling on her skin, under her clothes. Arya never looked up. If she saw them watching, all her courage would desert her, she knew, and she would drop the bundle of clothes and run and cry like a baby, and then they would have her. She kept her gaze on the ground. By the time she reached the shadow of the royal sept on the far side of the yard, Arya was cold with sweat, but no one had raised the hue and cry. The sept was open and empty. Inside, 50 prayer candles burned in a fragrant silence. Arya figured the guards would never miss two. She stuffed them up her sleeves and left by a back window. Sneaking back to the alley where she had cornered the one-eared Tom was easy, but after that she got lost. She crawled in and out of windows, hopping over walls, and felt her way through dark cellars, quiet as a shadow. Once she heard a woman weeping. It took her more than an hour to find the low, narrow window that slanted down to the dungeon where the monsters waited. She tossed her bundle through and doubled back to light her candle. That was Chauncey. The fire she'd remembered seeing had burnt down to embers, and she heard voices as she was blowing on the coals. Cupping her fingers around the flickering candle, she went out the window as they were coming in the door, without ever getting a glimpse of who it was. This time the monsters did not frighten her. They seemed almost old friends. Arya held the candle over her head. With each step she took, the shadows moved against the walls, as if they were turning to watch her pass. "Dragons," she whispered. She slid needle out from under her cloak. The slender blades seemed very small, and the dragons very big, yet somehow Arya felt better with steel in her hand. The long, windowless hall beyond the door was as black as she remembered. She held needle in her left hand, her sword hand, the candle in her right fist. Hot wax ran down across her knuckles. The entrance to the well had been to the left, so Arya went right. Part of her wanted to run, but she was afraid of snuffing out her candle. She heard the faint squeaking of rats and glimpsed a pair of tiny glowing eyes on the edge of the light. But rats did not scare her. Other things did. It would be so easy to hide here, as she had hidden from the wizard and the man with the forked beard. She could almost see the stable boy, standing against the wall, his hands curled into claws with the blood still dripping from the deep gashes in his palms where needle had cut him. He might be waiting to grab her as she passed. He would see her candle coming a long way off. Maybe she would be better off without the light. "Fear cuts deeper than swords," the quiet voice inside her whispered. Suddenly Arya remembered the crypts at Winterfell. They were a lot scarier than this place, she told herself. She'd been just a little girl the first time she saw them. Her brother Rob had taken them down, her and Sansa and baby Bran, who'd been no bigger than Rickon was now. They'd only one candle between them, and Bran's eyes had gotten as big as saucers as he stared at the stone faces of the kings of Winter with their wolves at their feet and their iron swords across their laps. Rob took them all the way down to the end, past Grandfather and Brandon and Lyanna, to show them their own tombs. Sansa kept looking at the stubby little candle, anxious that it might go out. Old Nan had told her there were spiders down here, and rats as big as dogs. Rob smiled when she said that. "There are worse things than spiders and rats," he whispered. "This is where the dead walk." That was when they had heard the sound, low and deep and shivery. Baby Bran had clutched at Arya's hand. When the spirit stepped out of the open tomb, pale, white, and moaning for blood, Sansa ran shrieking for the stairs, and Bran wrapped himself around Rob's leg, sobbing. Arya stood her ground and gave the spirit a punch. It was only Jon, covered with flour.
"You stupid," she told him. "You scared the baby."
But Jon and Rob just laughed and laughed, and pretty soon Bran and Arya were laughing too. The memory made Arya smile, and after that the darkness held no more terrors for her. The stable boy was dead. She'd killed him, and if he jumped out at her, she'd kill him again. She was going home. Everything would be better once she was home again, safe behind Winterfell's grey granite walls. Her footsteps sent soft echoes hurrying ahead of her as Arya plunged deeper into the darkness. Sansa. They came for Sansa on the third day. She chose a simple dress of dark grey wool, plainly cut, but richly embroidered around the collar and sleeves. Her fingers felt thick and clumsy as she struggled with the silver fastenings without the benefit of servants. Jane Poole had been confined with her, but Jane was useless. Her face was puffy from all her crying, and she could not seem to stop sobbing about her father. "I'm certain your father is well," Sansa told her when she had finally gotten the dress buttoned right. "I'll ask the Queen to let you see him." She thought that kindness might lift Jane's spirits, but the other girl just looked at her with red, swollen eyes and began to cry all the harder. She was such a child. Sansa had wept too the first day. Even within the stout walls of Meagher's Holdfast, with her door closed and barred, it was hard not to be terrified when the killing began. She had grown up to the sound of steel in the yard, and scarcely a day of her life had passed without hearing the clash of sword on sword. Yet somehow, knowing that the fighting was real, made all the difference in the world. She heard it as she had never heard it before, and there were other sounds as well. Grunts of pain, angry curses, shouts for help, and the moans of wounded and dying men. In the songs, the knights never screamed nor begged for mercy. So she wept, pleading through her door for them to tell her what was happening, calling for her father, for Septa Mordain, for the king, for her gallant prince. If the men guarding her heard her pleas, they gave no answer. The only time the door opened was late that night, when they thrust Jane Poole inside, bruised and shaking. "They're killing everyone," the steward's daughter had shrieked at her. She went on and on. The hound had broken down her door with a war hammer, she said. There were bodies on the stairs of the Tower of the Hand, and the steps were slick with blood. Sansa dried her own tears as she struggled to comfort her friend. They went to sleep in the same bed, cradled in each other's arms like sisters. The second day was even worse. The room where Sansa had been confined was at the top of the highest tower of Maegor's Holdfast. From its window, she could see the heavy iron portcullis in the gatehouse was down, and the drawbridge drawn up over the deep, dry moat that separated the keep within a keep from the larger castle that surrounded it. Lannister guardsmen prowled the walls with spears and crossbows to hand. The fighting was over, and the silence of the grave had settled over the Red Keep. The only sounds were Jane Poole's endless whimpers and sobs. They were fed, hard cheese and fresh-baked bread and milk to break their fast, roast chicken and greens at midday, and a late supper of beef and barley stew. But the servants who brought the meals would not answer Sansa's questions. That evening, some women brought her clothes from the Tower of the Hand, and some of Jane's things as well. But they seemed nearly as frightened as Jane, and when she tried to talk to them, they fled from her as if she had the grey plague. The guards outside the door still refused to let them leave the room. "Please, I need to speak to the Queen again," Sansa told them, as she told everyone she saw that day. "She'll want to talk to me, I know she will. Tell her I want to see her, please. If not the Queen, then Prince Joffrey, if you'll be so kind. We're to marry when we're older." At sunset on the second day, a great bell began to ring. Its voice was deep and sonorous, and the long, slow clanging filled Sansa with a sense of dread. The ringing went on, and after a while they heard other bells answering from the great sept of Baelor on Visenya's hill. The sound rumbled across the city like thunder, warning of the storm to come.
"What is it?" Jane asked, covering her ears. "Why are they ringing the bells?"
"The king is dead." Sansa could not say how she knew, yet she did. The slow, endless clanging filled their room, as mournful as a dirge. Had some enemy stormed the castle and murdered King Robert? Was that the meaning of the fighting they had heard? She went to sleep wondering, restless and fearful. Was her beautiful Joffrey the king now? Or had they killed him too? She was afraid for him and for her father. If only they would tell her what was happening. That night, Sansa dreamt of Joffrey on the throne, with herself seated beside him in a gown of woven gold. She had a crown on her head, and everyone she had ever known came before her to bend the knee and say their courtesies. The next morning, the morning of the third day, Sir Boris Blunt of the King's Guard came to escort her to the Queen. Sir Boris was an ugly man with a broad chest and short, bandy legs. His nose was flat, his cheeks baggy with jowls, his hair grey and brittle. Today he wore white velvet, and his snowy cloak was fastened with a lion brooch. The beast had the soft sheen of gold, and his eyes were tiny rubies. "You look very handsome and splendid this morning, Sir Boris," Sansa told him. A lady remembered her courtesies, and she was resolved to be a lady no matter what.
"And you, my lady," Sir Boris said in a flat voice. "Her Grace awaits. Come with me."
There were guards outside her door, Lannister men-at-arms in crimson cloaks and lion-crested helms. Sansa made herself smile at them pleasantly and bid them a good morning as she passed. It was the first time she had been allowed outside the chamber since Sir Aerys Oakheart had led her there two mornings past. "To keep you safe, my sweet one," Queen Cersei had told her. "Joffrey would never forgive me if anything happened to his precious." Sansa had expected that Sir Boris would escort her to the royal apartments, but instead he led her out of Maegor's holdfast. The bridge was down again. Some workmen were lowering a man on ropes into the depths of the dry moat. When Sansa peered down, she saw a body impaled on the huge iron spikes below. She averted her eyes quickly, afraid to ask, afraid to look too long, afraid he might be someone she knew. They found Queen Cersei in the council chambers, seated at the head of a long table littered with papers, candles, and blocks of sealing wax. The room was as splendid as any Sansa had ever seen. She stared in awe at the carved wooden screen and the two sphinxes that sat beside the door.
"Your Grace," Sir Boris said, when they were ushered inside by another of the King's Guard, Sir Mandon, of the curiously dead face, "I brought the girl."
Sansa had hoped Joffrey might be with her. Her prince was not there, but three of the king's counsellors were. Lord Petar Baelish sat on the queen's left hand, Grand Maester Pycelle at the end of the table, while Lord Varys hovered over them, smelling flowery. All of them were clad in black. She realized with a feeling of dread, mourning clothes. The queen wore a high-coloured black silk gown with 100 dark red rubies sewn into her bodice, covering her from neck to bosom. They were cut in the shape of teardrops, as if the queen were weeping blood. Cersei smiled to her, and Sansa thought it was the sweetest and saddest smile she had ever seen, "Sansa, my sweet child," she said, "I know you've been asking for me. I'm sorry that I could not send for you sooner. Matters have been very unsettled, and I've had not a moment. I trust my people have been taking good care of you?"
"Everyone has been very sweet and pleasant, Your Grace. Thank you ever so much for asking," Sansa said politely. "Only, well, no one will talk to us or tell us what's happened."
"Us?" Cersei seemed puzzled.
"We put the Stuart's girl in with her," Sir Boris said. "We did not know what else to do with her."
The Queen frowned.
"Next time you will ask," she said, her voice sharp. "The guards only know what sort of tales she's been filling Sansa's head with."
"Jane's scared," Sansa said. "She won't stop crying. I promised her I'd ask if she could see her father."
Old Grand Maester Pycelle lowered his eyes. "Her father is well, isn't he?" Sansa asked anxiously. She knew they had been fighting, but surely no one would harm a Stuart. Vaen Poole did not even wear a sword. Queen Cersei looked at each of the councillors in turn. "I won't have Sansa fretting needlessly. What should we do with this little friend of hers, my lords?"
Lord Petyr leaned forward. "I'll find a place for her."
"Not in the city," said the Queen.
"And do take me for a fool?"
The Queen ignored that. "Sir Boris, escort this girl to Lord Petyr's apartments and instruct his people to keep her there until he comes for her. Tell her that Littlefinger will be taking her to see her father. That ought to calm her down. I want her gone before Sansa returns to her chamber."
"As you command, Your Grace,"
Sir Boris said. He bowed deeply, spun on his heel, and took his leave, his long white cloak stirring the air behind him. Sansa was confused.
I don't understand," she said. "Where is Jane's father? Why can't Sir Boris take her to him, instead of Lord Petyr having to do it?"
She had promised herself she would be a lady, gentle as the Queen, and as strong as her mother, the Lady Catelyn, but all of a sudden she was scared again. For a second she thought she might cry.
"Where are you sending her? She hasn't done anything wrong. She's a good girl."
"She's upset you," the Queen said gently. "We can't be having that. Not another word now. Lord Baelish will see that Jane's well taken care of, I promise you." She patted the chair beside her. "Sit down, Sansa. I want to talk to you." Sansa seated herself beside the Queen. Cersei smiled again, but that did not make her feel any less anxious. Varys was wringing his soft hands together. Grand Maester Pycelle kept his sleepy eyes on the papers in front of him, but she could feel Littlefinger staring. Something about the way the small man looked at her made Sansa feel as though she had no clothes on. Goosebumps pimpled her skin. "Sweet Sansa," Queen Cersei said, laying a soft hand on her wrist. "Such a beautiful child. I do hope you know how much Joffrey and I love you."
"You do?"
Sansa said, breathless. Littlefinger was forgotten. Her prince loved her. Nothing else mattered. The Queen smiled. "I think of you almost as my own daughter, and I know the love you bear for Joffrey." She gave a weary shake of her head. "I'm afraid we've had some grave news about your lord father. You must be brave, child." Her quiet words gave Sansa a chill.
"What is it?"
"Your father is a traitor, dear," Lord Varys said.
Grand Maester Pycelle lifted his ancient head.
"It was my own ears I heard Lord Eddard swear to our beloved King Robert that he would protect the young princes as if they were his own sons. And yet the moment the king was dead, he called the small council together to steal Prince Joffrey's rightful throne."
"No," Sansa blurted. "He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't." The Queen picked up a letter. The paper was torn and stiff with dried blood, but the broken seal was her father's, the direwolf stamped in pale wax. "We found this on the captain of your household guard, Sansa. It is a letter to my late husband's brother, Stannis, inviting him to take the crown."
"Please, Your Grace, there's been a mistake. Sudden panic made her dizzy and faint. Please, send for my father. He'll tell you. He would never write such a letter. The king was his friend."
"Robert thought so," said the Queen. "This betrayal would have broken his heart." The gods are kind that he did not live to see it. She sighed. Sansa, sweetling, you must see what a dreadful position this has left us in. You are innocent of any wrong, we all know that, and yet you are the daughter of a traitor. How can I allow you to marry my son? But I love him, Sansa wailed, confused and frightened. What did they mean to do with her? What had they done to her father? It was not supposed to happen this way. She had to wed Joffrey. They were betrothed. He was promised to her. She'd even dreamed about it. It wasn't fair to take him away from her on account of whatever her father might have done.
Oh, how well I know that child, Cersei said, her voice so kind and sweet. Why else should you have come to me and told me of your father's plan to send you away from us, if not for love?
It was for love, Sansa said in a rush. Father wouldn't even give me leave to say farewell.
She was the good girl, the obedient girl, but she had felt as wicked as Arya that morning, sneaking away from Septa Mordain, defying her lord father. She had never done anything so willful before, and she would never have done it then, if she hadn't loved Joffrey as much as she did.
He was going to take me back to Winterfell and marry me to some hedge knight, even though it was Joff I wanted. I told him, but he wouldn't listen.
The king had been her last hope. The king could command father to let her stay in King's Landing and marry Prince Joffrey. Sansa knew he could. But the king had always frightened her. He was loud and rough-voiced and drunk as often as not, and he would probably just have sent her back to Lord Eddard if they had even let her see him. So she went to the queen instead, and poured out her heart, and Cersei had listened and thanked her sweetly. Only then Sir Aerys had escorted her to the high room in Maegar's Holdfast and posted guards, and a few hours later the fighting had begun outside.
"Please," she finished, "you have to let me marry Joffrey. I'll be ever so good a wife to him, you'll see. I'll be a queen just like you, I promise."
Queen Cersei looked to the others. "My lords of the council, what do you say to her plea?"
"The poor child," murmured Varys. "Loves her true and innocent, your grace. It would be cruel to deny it. And yet, what can we do? Her father stands condemned."
His soft hands washed each other in a gesture of helpless distress.
"A child born of traitor seed will find that betrayal comes naturally to her," said Grand Maester Pycelle. "She is a sweet thing now, but in 10 years, who can say what treason she may hatch?" "No," Sansa said, horrified. "I'm not. I'd never. I wouldn't betray Joffrey. I love him. I swear it, I do."
"Oh, so poignant," said Varys. "And yet it is truly said that blood runs truer than oaths. She reminds me of the mother, not the father," Lord Petyr Baelish said quietly. "Look at her. The hair, the eyes. She is the very image of Cat at the same age."
The queen looked at her, troubled, and yet Sansa could see kindness in her clear green eyes. "Child," she said, "if I could truly believe that you were not like your father, why, nothing should please me more than to see you wed to my Joffrey. I know he loves you with all his heart." She sighed. "And yet I fear that Lord Varys and the Grand Maester have the right of it. The blood will tell. I have only to remember how your sister set her wolf on my son." "I'm not like Arya," Sansa blurted. "She has the traitor's blood, not me. I'm good. Ask Septa Mordain, she'll tell you. I only want to be Joffrey's loyal and loving wife." She felt the weight of Cersei's eyes as the queen studied her face.
I believe you mean it, child."
She turned to face the others. "My lords, it seems to me that if the rest of her kin were to remain loyal in this terrible time, that would go a long way toward laying our fears to rest." Grand Maester Pycelle stroked his huge soft beard, his wide brow furrowed in thought.
"Lord Eddard has 3 sons.
"Mere boys," Lord Petyr said with a shrug. "I should be more concerned with Lady Catelyn and the Tullys." The queen took Sansa's hand in both of hers. "Child, do you know your letters?" Sansa nodded nervously.
She can read and write better than any of her brothers, although she was hopeless at sums. I am pleased to hear that. Perhaps there's hope for you and Geoffrey still. What do you want me to do? You must write your lady mother and your brother, the eldest. What is his name?
Rob, Sansa said.
The word of your lord father's treason will no doubt reach them soon. Better that it should come from you. You must tell them how Lord Eddard betrayed his king. Sansa wanted Geoffrey desperately, but she did not think that she had the courage to do as the queen was asking.
But he never... I don't... Your Grace, I wouldn't know what to say.
The queen patted her hand. We will tell you what to write, child. The important thing is that you urge Lady Catelyn and your brother to keep the king's peace.
It will go hard for them if they don't, said Grand Maester Pycelle. By the love you bear them, you must urge them to walk the path of wisdom.
Your lady mother will no doubt fear for you dreadfully, the queen said. You must tell her that you are well and in our care, that we are treating you gently and seeing to your every want. Bid them to come to King's Landing and pledge their fealty to Geoffrey when he takes his throne.
If they do that, why then we shall know there is no taint in your blood, and when you come into the flower of your womanhood, you shall wed the king in the great sept of Baelor before the eyes of gods and men.
Wed the king? The words made her breath come faster, yet still Sansa hesitated.
Perhaps if I might see my father, talk to him about
treason, Lord Varys hinted.
You disappoint me, Sansa, the queen said, with eyes gone hard as stones.
We've told you of your father's crimes. If you are truly as loyal as you say, why should you want to see him?
I only meant...
Sansa felt her eyes grow wet.
He's not... Please, he hasn't been... hurt or...
Lord Eddard has not been harmed, the queen said.
But what's to become of him? That is a matter for the king to decide, Grand Maester Pycelle announced ponderously.
The king? Sansa blinked back her tears. Geoffrey was the king now, she thought. Her gallant prince would never hurt her father, no matter what he might have done. If she went to him and pleaded for mercy, she was certain he'd listen. He had to listen. He loved her. Even the queen said so. Geoff would need to punish father. The lords would expect it, but perhaps he could send him back to Winterfell or exile him to one of the free cities across the narrow seas. It would only have to be for a few years. By then she and Geoffrey would be married, and once she was queen, she could persuade Geoff to bring father back and grant him a pardon. Only, if Mother or Rob did anything treasonous, called the banners, or refused to swear fealty or anything, it would all go wrong. Her Geoffrey was good and kind, she knew it in her heart, but a king had to be stern with rebels. She had to make them understand, she had to.
I'll write the letters, Sansa told them. With a smile as warm as the sunrise, Cersei Lannister leaned close and kissed her gently on the cheek.
I knew you would. Geoffrey will be so proud when I tell him what courage and good sense you've shown here today.
In the end, she wrote four letters. To her mother, the Lady Catelyn Stark, to her brothers at Winterfell, and to her aunt and her grandfather as well. Lady Lysa Arryn of the Eyrie, and Lord Hoster Tully of Riverrun. By the time she had done, her fingers were cramped and stiff and stained with ink. Varys had her father's seal. She warmed the pale white beeswax over a candle, poured it carefully, and watched as the eunuch stamped each letter with the dire wolf of House Stark. Jane Poole and all her things were gone when Sir Mandon Moore returned Sansa to the High Tower of Maegor's Holdfast. No more weeping, she thought gratefully, yet somehow it seemed colder with Jane gone, even after she'd built a fire. She pulled a chair close to the hearth, took down one of her favourite books, and lost herself in the stories of Florian and Jonquil,
of Lady Scheller and the Rainbow Knight, of valiant Prince Aemon and his doomed love for his brother's queen. It was not until later that night, as she was drifting off to sleep, that Sansa realized that she had forgotten to ask about her sister.
John. Arthur, announced Sir Jeremy Riker, the Underdart, and this one was J for Flowers. He turned the corpse over with his foot, and the dead white face stared up at the overcast sky with blue, blue eyes. They were Ben Sock's men, both of them. My uncle's men, John thought, numbly. He remembered how he'd pleaded to ride with them. Gods, I was such a green boy. If he'd taken me, it might be me lying there. Jaffa's right wrist ended in the ruin of torn flesh and splintered bone left by ghost jaws. His right hand was floating in a jar of vinegar back in Maester Aemon's tower. His left hand, still at the end of his arm, was as black as his cloak. "God's have mercy," the old bear muttered. He swung down from his garron, handed his reins to John. The morning was unnaturally warm. Beads of sweat dotted the Lord Commander's broad forehead like dew on a melon. His horse was nervous, rolling her eyes, backing away from the dead men as far as her lead would allow. John led her off a few paces, fighting to keep her from bolting. The horses did not like the feel of this place. For that matter, neither did John. The dogs liked it least of all. Ghost had led the party here. The pack of hounds had been useless. When Vass, the kennel master, had tried to get them to take the scent from the severed hand, they had all gone wild, yowling and barking, fighting to get away. Even now they were snarling and whimpering by turns, pulling at their leashes, while Chet cursed them for curs. "It's only a wood," John told himself. "And they're only dead men." He had seen dead men before. Last night he had dreamt the Winterfell dream again. He was wandering the empty castle, searching for his father, descending into the crypts. Only this time the dream had gone further than before. In the dark he'd heard the scrape of stone on stone, and when he turned he saw that the vaults were opening, one after the other, as the dead kings came stumbling from their coal-black graves. John had woken in pitch dark, his heart hammering. Even when Ghost leapt up on the bed to nuzzle at his face, he could not shake the deep sense of terror. He dared not go back to sleep. Instead, he had climbed the wall and walked, restless, until he saw the light of dawn off to the east. It was only a dream. I am a brother of the Night's Watch now, not a frightened boy. Samwell Tarly huddled beneath the trees, half-hidden behind the horses. His round, fat face was the colour of curdled milk. So far he had not lurched off to the woods to retch, but he had not so much as glanced at the dead man either.
"I can't look," he whispered miserably.
"You have to look," John told him, keeping his voice low so the others would not hear. "Maester Aemon sent you to be his eyes, didn't he? What good are eyes if they're shot?"
"Yes, but I'm such a coward, John."
John put a hand on Sam's shoulder. "We have a dozen rangers with us, and the dogs, even Ghost. No one will hurt you, Sam. Go ahead and look." "The first look is the hardest." Sam gave a tremulous nod, working up his courage with a visible effort. Slowly, he swiveled his head. His eyes whitened, but John held his arm so he could not turn away.
"Sir Jeremy," the old bear said gruffly, "Ben Stark had 6 men with him when he rode from the wall. Where are the others?"
Sir Jeremy shook his head.
"Would that I knew."
Plainly, Mormont was not pleased with that answer.
"2 of our brothers butchered almost within sight of the wall, yet your rangers heard nothing, saw nothing. Is this what the Night's Watch has fallen to?" Do we still sweep these woods?
Yes, my lord, but do we still mount watches? We do, but this man wears a hunting horn.
Mormon pointed at Arthur.
Must I suppose he died without sounding it? Or have your rangers all gone deaf as well as blind?
Sir Jeremy bristled, his face taunt with anger.
No horn was blown, my lord, or my rangers would have heard it. I do not have sufficient men to mount as many patrols as I should like, and since Benjamin was lost, we have stayed closer to the wall than we were wont to do before, by your own command.
The old bear grunted.
Yes, well, be that as it may.
He made an impatient gesture.
Tell me how they died.
Squatting beside the dead man he had named Japheth Flowers, Sir Jeremy grasped the head by the scalp. The hair came out between his fingers, brittle as straw. The knight cursed and shoved at the face with the heel of his hand. A great gash in the side of the corpse's neck opened like a mouth, crusted with dry blood. Only a few ropes of pale tendon still attached the head to the neck.
This was done with an axe.
"Oi," muttered Diwan, the old forester. "Be like the axe that Utter carried, me lord."
John could feel his breakfast churning in his belly, but he pressed his lips together and made himself look at the second body. Utter had been a big, ugly man, and he made a big, ugly corpse. No axe was in evidence. John remembered Arthur. He had been the one bellowing the bawdy song as the rangers rode out. His singing days were done. His flesh was blanched white as milk. Everywhere but his hands. His hands were black like Japheth's. Blossoms of hard, cracked blood decorated the mortal wounds that covered him like a rash, breast and groin and throat. Yet his eyes were still open. They stared up at the sky, blue as sapphires. Sir Jeremy stood.
The wildlings have access too.
Mormont rounded on him.
So you believe this is Mance Raider's work, hm? This close to the wall? Or who else, my lord?
John could have told him. He knew, they all knew. Yet no man of them would say the words.
The others are only a story, a tale to make children shiver. If they ever lived at all, they were gone 8,000 years.
Even the thought made him feel foolish. He was a man grown now, a black brother of the Night's Watch, not the boy who once sat at old Nan's feet with Bran and Rob and Arya. Yet Lord Commander Mormont gave a snort.
If Ben Stark had come under a wilding attack, a half-day's ride from Castle Black, he would return for more men, chase the killers through all seven hells, and brought me back their heads.
Unless he was slain as well, Sir Jeremy insisted.
The words hurt, even now. It had been so long it seemed folly to cling to the hope that Ben Stark was still alive. But Jon Snow was nothing if not stubborn.
It has been close on half a year since Benjen left us, my lord, Sir Jeremy went on. The forest is fast. The wildlings might have fallen on him anywhere. I'd wager these two were the last survivors of his party on their way back to us. But the enemy caught them before they could reach the safety of the wall. The corpses are still fresh. These men cannot have been dead more than a day.
No!
Samuel Tarly squeaked. John was startled. Sam's nervous, high-pitched voice was the last he would have expected to hear. The fat boy was frightened of the officers, and Sir Jeremy was not known for his patience.
I did not ask for your views, boy,
Riker said coldly. Let him speak, sir, John blurted. Mormont's eyes flicked from Sam to John and back again.
If the lad has something to say, I'll hear him. Come closer, boy. We can't see you behind those horses.
Sam edged past John and the Garrons, sweating profusely.
My lord, it can't be a day, or look, the blood.
Yes, Mormont growled impatiently. Blood? What of it?
"'He soils his small clothes at the sight of it,'
Chet shouted out, and the rangers laughed. Sam mopped at the sweat on his brow.
"'You can see where Ghost, John's direwolf, you can see where he tore off the man's hand, and yet the stump hasn't bled. Look!'
He waved a hand.
"'My father, Lord Randall, he made me watch him dress animals sometimes when, after—'
Sam shook his head from side to side, his chins quivering. Now that he had looked at the bodies, he could not seem to look away.
"'A fresh kill, the blood would still flow, my lords. Later, it would be clotted like a jelly, thick and—'
He looked as if he was going to be sick.
"'This man, look at the wrist. It's all crusty, dry, like—'
John saw at once what Sam meant. He could see the torn veins in the dead man's wrist, iron worms in the pale flesh. His blood was a black dust, yet Jeremy Riker was unconvinced.
"'If they'd been dead much longer than a day, they'd be ripe by now, boy. They don't even smell.'
Dywin, the gnarled old forester, who'd like to boast that he could smell snow coming on, sidled closer to the corpses and took a whiff.
"'Well, there are no pansy flowers, but, my lord, as the truth of it, there's no corpse stink.
They aren't rotting,'
Sam pointed, his fat finger shaking only a little.
"'Look, there's no maggots or worms or anything. They've been lying here in the woods, but they haven't been chewed or eaten by animals. Only ghosts. Otherwise, they're—'
"'Untouched,' John said softly. "'And ghost is different. The dogs and the horses won't go near them.' The rangers exchanged glances. They could see it was true, every man of them. Mormont frowned, glancing from the corpses to the dogs.
"'Chet, bring the hounds closer!'
Chet tried, cursing, yanking on the leashes, giving one animal a lick of his boot. Most of the dogs just whimpered and planted their feet. He tried dragging one. The bitch resisted, growling and squirming as if to escape her collar. Finally she lunged at him. Chet dropped the leash and stumbled backwards. The dog leapt over him and bounded off into the trees.
This is all wrong, Sam Tarley said earnestly. The blood, there's bloodstains on the clothes and their flesh dry and hard, but there's none on the ground or anywhere. With those
Sam made himself swallow, took a deep breath.
With those wounds, terrible wounds, there should be blood all over, shouldn't there?
Dywin sucked at his wooden teeth.
Might be they didn't die here. Might be someone brought them and left them for us. A warning, as like.
The old forester peered down suspiciously.
"'And might be. I'm a fool, but I don't know that Utter never had no blue eyes afore.'
Sir Jeremy looked startled.
"'Neither do flowers,'
he blotted, turning to stare at the dead man. A silence fell over the wood. For a moment all they heard was Sam's heavy breathing and the wet sound of Dywin sucking on his teeth. John squatted beside Ghost. "'Burn them!' someone whispered. One of the rangers. John could not have said who.
"'Yes, burn them!'
a second voice urged. The old bear gave a stubborn shake of his head.
"'Not yet. I want Maester Eamon to look at them. We'll bring them back to the wall.'
Some commands are more easily given than obeyed. They wrapped the dead men in cloaks, but when Hake and Dywin tried to tie one onto a horse, the animal went mad, screaming and rearing, lashing out with its hooves, even biting at Ketter when he ran to help.
The rangers had no better luck with the other Garrons. Not even the most placid wanted any part of these burdens. In the end, they were forced to hack off branches and fashion crude slings to carry the corpses back on foot. It was well past midday by the time they started back. "I will have these woods searched," Mormont commanded Sir Jeremy as they set out. "Every tree, every rock, every bush, and every foot of muddy ground within 10 leagues of here. Use all the men you have, and if you do not have enough, borrow hunters and foresters from the Stuarts. If Ben and the others are out there, dead or alive, I will have them found. And if there is anyone else in these woods, I will know of it. You are to track them and take them, alive if possible. Is that understood?"
"It is, my lord," Sir Jeremy said. "It will be done."
After that, Mormont rode in silence, brooding. John followed close behind him. As the Lord Commander Stuart, that was his place. The day was grey, damp, overcast, the sort of day that made you wish for rain. No wind stirred the wood. The air hung humid and heavy, and John's clothes clung to his skin. It was warm, too warm. The wall was weeping copiously, had been weeping for days, and sometimes John even imagined it was shrinking. The old men called this weather Spirit Summer, and said it meant the season was giving up its ghosts at last. After this, the cold would come, they warned. And a long summer always meant a long winter. The summer had lasted 10 years. John had been a babe in arms when it began. Ghost ran with them for a time, and then vanished among the trees. Without the direwolf, John felt almost naked. He found himself glancing at every shadow with unease. Unbidden, he thought back to the tales that old Nan used to tell them when he was a boy at Winterfell. He could almost hear her voice again, and the click, click, click of her needles.
"In that darkness, the others come riding," she used to say, dropping her voice lower and lower. "Cold and dead they were, and they hated iron and fire and the touch of the sun, and every living creature with hot blood in its veins, holdfasts and cities, and kingdoms of men all fell before them as they moved south on pale, dead horses, leading hosts of the slain. They fed their dead servants on the flesh of human children."
When he caught his first glimpse of the wall, looming above the tops of an ancient gnarled oak, John was vastly relieved. Mormont reined up suddenly and turned in his saddle.
"Tarly," he barked, "come here."
John saw the start of fright on Sam's face as he lumbered up on his mare. Doubtless, he thought, he was in trouble.
"You're fat, but you're not stupid, boy," the old bear said gruffly. "You did well back there. And you, Snow."
Sam blushed a vivid crimson and tripped over his own tongue as he tried to stammer out a courtesy. John had to smile. When they emerged from under the trees, Mormont spurred his tough little Garron to a trot. Ghost came streaking out of the woods to meet them, licking his chops, his muzzle red from prey. High above, the men on the wall saw the column approaching. John heard the deep, throaty call of the watchman's great horn, calling out across the miles, a single long blast that shuddered through the trees and echoed off the ice. The sound faded slowly to silence. One blast meant rangers returning, and John thought,
"I was a ranger, for one day at least. Whatever may come, they can't take that away from me."
Bowen Marsh was waiting at the first gate as they led the Garrons through the icy tunnel. The Lord Stuart was red-faced and agitated.
"My lord," he blurted at Mormont as he swung open the iron bars, "there's been a bird. You must come at once."
"What is it, men?" Mormont said gruffly. Curiously, Marsh glanced at John before he answered. "Maester Aemon has a letter. He's waiting in your cellar." "Very well, John. See to my horse and tell Sir Jeremy to put the dead men in a storeroom until the maester is ready for them." Mormont strode away, grumbling. As they led their horses back to the stable, John was uncomfortably aware that people were watching him. Sir Alistair Thorne was drilling his boys in the yard, but he broke off to stare at John, a faint half-smile on his lips. One-armed Donald Noy stood in the door of the armory. "The guards be with you, Snow," he called out. "Something's wrong," John thought. "Something's very wrong." The dead men were carried to one of the storerooms along the base of the wall, a dark coal cell chiseled from the ice and used to keep meat and grain, and sometimes even beer. John saw the Mormont's horse was fed and watered and groomed before he took care of his own. Afterwards he sought out his friends. Gren and Toad were on watch, but he found Pip in the common hall. "What's happened?" he asked. Pip lowered his voice. "The king's dead." John was stunned. Robert Baratheon had looked old and fat when he visited Winterfell, yet he seemed hale enough, and there had been no talk of illness. "How can you know?" "One of the guards over here, Clydes, regained the letter to Maester Aemon." Pip leaned close. "John, I'm sorry. He was your father's friend, wasn't he?"
They were as close as brothers once. John wondered if Joffrey would keep his father as the king's hand. It did not seem likely. That might mean Lord Eddard would return to Winterfell, and his sisters as well. He might even be allowed to visit them with Lord Mormont's permission. It would be good to see Arya's grin again and to talk with his father.
"I will ask him about my mother," he resolved. "I'm a man now. It's past time, he told me. Even if she was a whore, I don't care. I want to know."
"I heard Ake say the dead men were your uncles," Pip said.
"Yes," John replied. "Two of the six he took with him. They've been dead a long time, only the bodies are queer."
"Queer?"
Pip was all curiosity.
"How queer?"
"Sam will tell you." John did not want to talk of it. "I should see if the old bear has need of me." He walked to the Lord Commander's tower alone with a curious sense of apprehension. The brothers on guard eyed him solemnly as he approached.
"The old bear's in his solar," one of them announced. "He was asking for you."
John nodded. He should have come straight from the stable. He climbed the tower steps briskly. "He wants wine, or a fire in his hearth, that's all," he told himself. When he entered the solar, Mormont's raven screamed at him.
"Corn!"
the bird shrieked.
"Corn! Corn! Corn!" "Don't you believe it, I just fed him," the old bear growled.
He was seated by the window reading a letter.
"Bring me a cup of wine and pour one for yourself."
"For myself, my lord."
Mormont lifted his eyes from the letter to stare at John. There was pity in that look. He could taste it.
"You heard me."
John poured with exaggerated care, vaguely aware that he was drawing out the act. When the cups were filled, he would have no choice but to face whatever was in that letter. Yet all too soon, they were filled.
"Sit, boy," Mormont commanded him. "Drink."
John remained standing. "It's my father, isn't it?" The old bear tapped the letter with a finger.
"Your father and the king," he rumbled. "I won't lie to you. It's grievous news. I never thought to see another king, not at my age, with Robert half my years and strong as a bull."
He took a gulp of wine.
"They say the king loved to hunt. The things we love destroy us every time, lad. Remember that. My son loved that young wife of his, vain woman. If not for her, he would never have thought to sell those poachers."
John could scarcely follow what he was saying. "My lord, I don't understand. What's happened to my father?"
"I told you to sit," Mormont grumbled.
"Sit,"
the raven screeched.
Have a drink, damn you. That's a command, Snow.
John sat and took a sip of wine.